inna Canada, also inna England. Unite to free up the mother's land, the freedom fighter. Moving on the African border, Bangli war, freedom fighters. Moving on the African border. All your sophisticated weapon and your nuclear missile.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with the late Lucky Dube and Freedom Fighter to introduce the 20-year anniversary of F.W. de Klerk's announcement that Nelson Mandela and all political prisoners would be unconditionally released. We will hear several different perspectives about this. We will also hear from freedom fighters who feel they've been betrayed by the current leadership after lifetimes dedicated to fighting for democracy in South Africa. And I'll share how the media in South Africa is viewing the latest scandal rocking Jacob Zuma's presidency and the African National Congress, the party, of course, that Nelson Mandela spent his life developing and supporting. On February 2, 1990, former president of the Nationalist Party, F.W. de Klerk, announced, and I quote, "The prohibition of the African National Congress, the Pan-Africanist Congress, the South African Communist Party, and the number of subsidiary organizations is being rescinded. People serving prison sentences merely because they were members of one of these organizations will be identified and released. The restrictions in terms of the emergency regulations on 33 organizations, including National Education Crisis Committee, South African National Students Congress, United Democratic Front, COSATU, are being rescinded." And he also said, "I wish to put it plainly that the government has taken a firm decision to release Mr. Mandela unconditionally." In an article written for this year's anniversary to commemorate his part in that day, de Klerk states, "One of the questions I am invariably asked in international interviews is whether a Damascene conversion led me to initiate the changes that I announced on February 2, 1990. At the root of the question lie somewhat simplistic views of the development of government policy before 1994. The whole period between 1948 and 1994 is generally regarded as, quote, the era of apartheid, unquote, which is seen as an undifferentiated time of white racial domination, repression, and exploitation. Accordingly, the only explanation for the 180-degree turn of February 2, 1990 is that it must have been the result of some kind of quasi-religious epiphany. In fact, there were enormous developments in National Party policy between 1948 and 1994. The first decade under Prime Minister Milan and Strædom was a period of undisguised white domination, characterized by rigid segregation and pervasive paternalism. It is shocking to recall this now. However, it is equally shocking to note that the attitudes involved were not so different from those that then still prevailed in the European colonial empires and in the southern states of the U.S. The period between 1958 and 1978, under Prime Minister Verwoerd and Foster, was characterized by the implementation of, quote, separate development, unquote, the idea that we could somehow unscramble the South African omelet and create a commonwealth of Southern African states, all working happily in harmony and co-prosperity. One of the many problems with Verwoerdian ideology was that it allocated less than 14% of the country to more than 70% of the people. Another was that the economy was becoming more integrated with every year that passed. The most serious was that the ideology was firmly rejected by the vast majority of people involved. It's a long article. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. De Klerk ended it with, quote, "February 2, 1990 was not an epiphany or Damascene conversion. It was the culmination of a long and torturous search for a solution to the vexatious questions that had divided South Africans for generations." F.W. de Klerk is now chairman of the F.W. de Klerk Foundation. Thabo Mbeki concurs with de Klerk that much work and negotiation had gone on before the announcement. He writes, "As we commemorate February 2nd, the day 20 years ago when then-President F.W. de Klerk announced the unbanning of the ANC and other organizations and committed the National Party and the South African government to negotiations that would lead to a new South Africa, we must surely celebrate the fact that we proved we could solve our problems by talking to one another. The failure to talk to one another had imposed a very high cost on our people and the country. It also meant that some of the most outstanding representatives of our people had to spend many years in prison while others were forced into exile." Thabo Mbeki was in Sweden when this news came through. He actually already knew, of course, that this was in the works. He writes that the ANC leaders had received my earlier report about what de Klerk would say with a degree of caution attested in part to the manner in which both the ANC and the government had honored the need for strict confidentiality. Both sides had agreed that they would do everything possible, including keeping their negotiations confidential, to give each other the time and space to achieve the delicate objective of carrying their respective constituencies, especially bearing in mind that historical antagonism and mistrust between them. Indeed, some of those who opposed change in 1989 have still not changed their minds to this day. That's a piece from Thabo Mbeki's commemoration for the 20th anniversary. So while the majority of South Africans felt the winds of hope, Conservative Party leader of the time, extremist Ferdinand Hotzenberg, was alarmed. Today, the 72-year-old of the now extinct party concedes he may have misjudged history. He now introduces himself as an emerging farmer. Aging, pleasant, and somewhat vulnerable, the once feared, bespeckled, and chevron moustached Dr. Ferdinand Hotzenberg has retired to his home of Lichtenberg in the northwest. He seems a tad uncomfortable talking about the memories of his attempt to stop the crumbling apartheid wall. He said, and I quote, "We opposed it, but it has happened. I think it would have happened in a different way because it was not a settlement, it was a takeover. I think the real settlement lies somewhere in the future. That's why I say that I think it's too early to judge because things must develop." This is the man who was once the Minister of Bantu Affairs as well as of Black Education. While the National Party and the ANC believed in a negotiated settlement amidst a resistance from hardliners within both of these organizations, Hotzenberg and his opponents in the far left saw war as a solution. Back then, he had a vicious tongue laden with war talk. Today, he's a soft-spoken grandfather who does not consider himself an erstwhile warmonger. Quote, "We didn't plan any offensive initiative, only defensive. If we were forced and if we were threatened, we thought we would have to defend ourselves." This is what he says when asked about his 1990 Civil War threats. He called his supporters to join his commandos and arm themselves as late as 1993, declaring Pretoria the capital of the Volksstaat on the eve of the 1994 elections. Today, Hotzenberg has promised never to enter the political arena again. You're listening to Raising Sand Radio, KZSU FM 90.1 out of Stanford University. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and today we are reviewing comments from the 20th anniversary of the announcement of the release of Nelson Mandela and other political parties. Mosibundu Magnena, president of the Azanian People's Organization, or ZAPO, spent 5 years on Robben Island while Nelson Mandela was imprisoned there. The two communicated clandestinely, speaking, when possible, through a small hole at the bottom of the door separating their two prison sections and via secret letters. Today, Magnena writes, "Amid hiccups every now and then, the negotiations between the ANC and the regime intensified after the release of Mandela, leading ultimately to CODESA at Kempton Park, where the details of the final settlement were concluded. ZAPO and the BCMA, the Black Consciousness Movement, did not take part in CODESA and boycotted the first democratic election in 1994. Although the political logic for boycotting the elections was clear, it is now apparent that non-participation was a serious strategic and tactical mistake. Those elections shifted electoral and parliamentary politics to the center, marginalizing extra-parliamentary political activity. Non-participation in those first elections marginalized the ZAPO, and recovery from that tactical mistake has proved difficult. The essence of the guarantees and assurances is laid bare in the final constitution of the land. The much-vaunted South African constitution, touted as the most liberal in the world, entrenches the positions of blacks and whites in the categories they were in before the 1994 elections. Basically, black people have gained the vote, flattering titles such as president and minister, shiny cars, and the associated pomp and ceremony. Whites have retained the land as well as control and ownership of the economy. In addition, whites have gained legitimacy and acceptance by the rest of Africa, enabling their big businesses to venture into the continent in a big way. South African banks, supermarket chains and telecoms, mining and service companies are doing business all over the continent. The epoch-making release of Mandela 20 years ago has seen to it that we are no longer politically oppressed, arrested, imprisoned or killed, and that the whole South African region is at peace with itself. However, a truly democratic and more equal society is still a long way off. That requires that we work hard towards its realization, failing which this democratic order may just crumble before our eyes." That is Magnena, president of the Azanian People's Organization. If you are just tuning in, this is KZSU FM 90.1, Raising Sand Radio, a weekly show on Stanford University, bringing excerpts from the 20th anniversary of the unconditional release of Nelson Mandela, which was celebrated on February 2nd. At that time, all political parties and prisoners were released. Let's consider Magnena here suggesting that perhaps true democracy has not arrived. Thousands of Africans from many walks of life participated for decades to overturn the apartheid regime. The armed wing of the ANC, Umkhonto we Sizwe, or MK, fought, and many of those who fought feel their dedication has been ignored and disrespected. The South African Broadcasting Corporation aired a show on its program called Special Assignment with some of those forgotten after that liberation. We'll hear from them.
In 1996, the state introduced a special pension fund to compensate South Africans who contributed to the establishment of democracy. But as our investigation reveals, many poor veterans and their families are robbed by questionable administrators who use the fund to enrich themselves and defraud the state. Our producer, Busisi Wenduli, traveled to Bizana in the Eastern Cape and compiled this report.
A great number of people fought in defiance of apartheid. The battle stretched from rural peasant struggles such as the Pondoland Revolt to the urban waves of uprisings across the breadth of South Africa. We travelled to Bizana in the Eastern Cape, where poor and desperate veterans and their families are robbed by questionable administrators who use the existence of the fund to enrich themselves and defraud the state. This is Eastern Pondoland, the land of struggle hero Oliver Tambo. Despite its great history, Bizana is a town devoid of any development. Helplessness and poverty are its defining features. In this and other towns of Eastern Pondoland, such as Lusikisiki and Flagstaff, live thousands of survivors and victims of the 1960 Pondoland Revolt. We went to see one of the leaders of this momentous struggle, who today is homeless and stays in this warehouse shared by other homeless people.
My name is Leonard Makashu Mdingi, born 1926 at Inchamate location, Bizana.
Mdingi is a former Ndlavini leader, or a movement of radical rural migrant labourers in the Transkei. Revered for his bravery and steadfastness, among others, he led the historically acclaimed Pondoland Revolt in 1960, which mobilised the rural folk in defiance of the much-despised Bantu Authorities Act.
It was taking away their cattle. It was going to fence the residential areas. It was going to fence off pastures. People were not happy with this Bantu Authorities Act. And they started telling the government that, no, we are not happy with this law. Take it away.
The Pondos rallied around a cause to stop a law that undermined their very existence. They held meetings in the nearby Ikuza and Ndlovu Hills to stop this imposition.
They were implementing their own laws, their own way of governing themselves. And were openly saying they are not going to pay tax, poll tax. And the government didn't like that.
This unleashed the might of the apartheid government. Hundreds of people were killed. Some, like Mdingi, were arrested, tortured and banished. Mdingi spent 15 years confined to a small area in Durban, but continued working underground. Today, this area is full of poverty-stricken victims and survivors of those sustained battles of resistance. Yet, for many like Mdingi, their dignity has not been restored. He still cannot get a house.
I can't get a house. I don't know why. You see, what happened was this. When this, this a place here, just outside here, Bizana, and I applied for a house. They said, no, you wait. You are on the list. Since then, I've been on the list.
Mdingi received a struggle veteran special pension from government. Despite having spent over 40 years in the struggle, he was only recognized for 11 years of those. With that money, he bought a sewing machine, which he uses to sell traditional clothes. This workshop also doubles as his home, a travesty of justice for a life dedicated to the realization of dignity for all.
Nobody takes that into account. I've been staying in these places, these hovels, for all the time. Since I arrived here, I think it was around 1986. And I've been staying like this.
It's exactly for people like him that the government established the special pension fund to compensate those who served to establish democracy. So far, over 50,000 special pension applications have been made, with only 16,000 approved.
People who served full-time in political organizations during the struggle for liberation were not able to start their lives like everybody else and start providing for a pension for their times when they retire.
Special Assignment received this leaked report alleging fraud and corruption, naming some state officials as well as other local administrators in Bizana. It alleges, among others, collusion to charge the veterans fees for making applications on their behalf.
We have received a report from that area, not only that area, but we do get reports of people that were either defrauding the state or that claimed to have submitted their forms with the individuals who otherwise were not employed by the state, and those people collected money for forms and all sorts of things.
This is Gertrude Tambo, sister of the late Oliver Tambo. We visited her in the same house where the struggle stalwart was raised. Gertrude is desperate and poor and only survives on her old age pension. She feels aggrieved about many things, but chief among those is her brother's legacy. She was also persuaded to apply for a special pension. Just like many others, she had to pay for the assistance. Her application has been declined. It seems she was misled because the law disqualifies her as she's neither a spouse nor a dependent of OR. Gertrude Tambo visits her brother's memorial once in a while. These two men used to be partners. They recruited each other to organize struggle veterans in Bizana and help them apply for their special pensions. But they had a fallout, and both have been fingered by many old people as the culprits who made them pay for their services. But both are now pointing fingers at each other.
You see, these people I think here are those people who were made. Were given biograph. Only biograph was sent to Pretoria by Scutra. Biograph, applying for special pension.
Files seen by Special Assignment mostly have the same handwriting, purported to be that of Sekutwa. As seen on this document enlisting the applicants, most of them also use the same postal address, apparently belonging to Sekutwa. It has also emerged that a law firm called M. Nokwe and Partners was brought in under the pretext of helping people in getting head office to release their special pensions. The asking price, 500 rand from each of the hundreds of hopeful applicants. We tried calling the numbers appearing on the receipts and a mobile number provided for the firm.
The number you have called is not available on the MTN network.
Our source confirmed that previously some of these officials worked with employees of the local branch of FNB. Now the former partners accuse each other. This was the response from FNB, saying that their investigation shows that the alleged incident did not take place at their Bizana branch. Interestingly, Special Assignment has received bank statements from another FNB client in Durban, who is also a special pension applicant, who falls under the same special pension administrative area as that of Bizana. Her bank statements show that she's had multiple payments of thousands of rands into her FNB account, despite her claim that she doesn't know about these payments. According to the Special Investigation Unit, in 2007, just over 6,000 cases were to be investigated and just over 3 million rand worth of losses were prevented. But there's widespread talk that the fraud is persisting.
The Special Investigation Unit has actually been very useful, and we are going to continue working with them. When people have such cases, we appeal to people to come forward and report such cases, and we want the law to take its course.
In many parts of the country, people feel left behind now that the fruits of democracy have been realized. We travel to Zeerust in the northwest province to meet an old veteran who now lives in the village of Kopane. Mesina Kitseng is 93 years old and bedridden. She's credited for having taken care of exiles in Botswana, including Nelson Mandela, whom she hid in her house for 2 weeks. She also applied for the special pension in 1998, and her application was declined. She says no reason was given for the rejection. She now fears that her grandsons face a bleak future since she won't be able to be there for them much longer. This is a meeting of people who call themselves Struggle Veterans Action Committee in Cape Town. They say they fought in the street, but unlike other groups, they are not being recognized.
We did make this country ungovernable, and it is our members that has done that. I mean, Battle of Belgravia in Bontevo itself was on fire. Alsace River was on fire. Khayelitsha was on fire. Guguletu was on fire. And those were not necessarily from people from MK, in a sense that it was the ordinary call by people to want to take, to dismantle apartheid. Government has just never really taken the time to put, to register the people that fought the battle on the streets of this country.
You do not qualify by just having been a member of MK. You must have been serving in your organization, and that is verified by your organization. You must have been serving full-time in your organization for 5 years. Your organization must have been banned, and all the criteria must be met. So there are a number of people in MK who also do not meet the criteria.
This group and others, such as military veterans of Azanla and Apla, accuse the administrators of bias. But all former liberation movements see it as problematic. Other major concerns include the age of eligibility.
We had comrades who were young, who left the country being 14 years or 16 years of age. And these comrades were in the front line, especially in Angola. Some of them died in Angola, some of them died in Uganda, Tanzania. And we proposed the age be 25 in 1996, but we were defeated by people in parliament that no, you should be 30 years. But we're not happy with that, but we're saying we've won the battle, not the war.
This is the third time we're moving with the amendment of age. We moved from 45 to 35, people that were 35 in 1996. We have since moved now to people that were between 30 and 35. The issue of age also takes into account whether that person was, because we're trying to look at whether you were really prevented from providing for a pension for your retirement.
For the young lions to choose to go to fight and leave school, it tells you something. And therefore, for us when we were fighting, we said struggle now, education after. So we're consciously saying we want to overthrow the apartheid regime.
If I was out of the country with my parents at age 10, when I returned at age 20, then I had adequate time to be able to start a life. It's not only people that were outside that could have been excluded from entering the labor market. Some of us were never out of the country, were never imprisoned, but were not able to provide for a decent living by being able to start working.
So many years later, Leonard Mdingi is still a committed member of his organization. As he talks about what he went through, the memories come flashing back. Despite everything else, Mdingi insists that it was all worth it. He says, maybe one day they will remember us. If not, then history will be the judge.
Was a special assignment show aired recently with the Forgotten of the MK. Keeping in mind Mdingi's words, maybe one day they will remember us or history will be the judge, let's turn to an extract from a speech delivered by Democratic Alliance leader Helen Zille at the F.W. de Klerk Foundation celebration of the 20-year anniversary of de Klerk's speech. This is an excerpt, as I say, and she has a lot of concerns that she's raising here about the current state of affairs.
At the heart of institutionalism is the notion that no ruler or ruling party, no matter how popular, can do as they please. They are bound by the constitution and the law. These qualities tend to be absent in liberation movements for obvious reasons. Liberation movements operate in conditions of secrecy and hierarchy. The antithesis of key democratic values like openness and participation. Liberation is regarded purely as the seizure and control of all levers of power, not the limiting of power once it is attained. This explains why the democratic record of liberation movements on our continent is so woeful. As the scholar Marina Ottaway warned in the early 90s, nowhere in Africa has a liberation movement spawned a truly democratic regime. But under Nelson Mandela, it seems as if the ANC, in the spirit of South African exceptionalism, would successfully make the shift from liberation movement to political party. There was a general understanding and acceptance of the need to limit political power to avoid the mistakes of the past. As Nelson Mandela said, when our interim constitution was adopted, we enter in a covenant that we shall build a society in which all South Africans, both black and white, will be able to walk tall, without any fear in their hearts, assured of the inalienable right to human dignity, a rainbow nation at peace with itself and the world. This notion of a covenant is absent in the ANC of today's discourse because of the constitutionalists in the ANC are losing the interminable battle of the party soul. The group in the ascendancy believes that liberation means unfettered power to impose its will. They are the modern-day South African versions of the Jacobins. In a historical irony, the word Jacobins fits our circumstances perfectly, not just for political reasons, but because the name Jacobins is a wordplay on the name of their current leader, Jacob Zuma. Like the Jacobins of revolutionary France, the Jacobins' goal is to attain absolute power, an end in which always justifies the means. And, like the original Jacobins, they are guided not by the Constitution, which guarantees each person's individual rights, but the general will, which they define arbitrary, as they please to achieve their goal of entrenching power. Not surprisingly, the Jacobins tend to be drawn from the ANC's external armed wing. The influence of the Jacobins permeates the movement. Consider, for example, the recent rise of war veterans associated with their violent rhetoric, We have become so insured to what Kader Osmal refers to as the militarization of the ANC's discourse that an injunction to kill a public figure barely raises eyebrows anymore. And when we look beyond the quaintness of a singing and dancing president, we are reminded of the absurdity of the leader of a constitutional democracy demanding his machine gun. For the Jacobins, the ANC comes first and the Constitution second. As Zuma has said, the ANC is more important than even the Constitution of this country. The Constitution is no longer a sacred covenant that binds us all. It is a hindrance to be pushed aside when it gets in the way. As ANC Chief Whip Mathola Motsekga said recently, Jacob Zuma has a mandate from 11 million people, so he can do what he likes, or words to that effect. One of the most sobering realizations over the past year has been recognizing that a constitution can be effectively nullified without changing a single word of it. This happens when the institution that are supposed to limit the power of the ruling party merely becomes an extension of the dominant clique in the ruling party. When this happens, the entire purpose of the constitution is subverted so that it protects the party and not the people. There can be no better illustration of this than the neutering of the National Prosecuting Authority, which is the NPA, at the hands of Zuma and the Jacobins. With 783 charges of corruption, bribery, money laundering, and racketeering against Zuma, not to mention a financial advisor in jail for bribing him, the Jacobins' realization that the constitutional principle of prosecutorial independence was the key obstacle in the way of Zuma's ascent to the presidency. So they turned the NPA from an institution designed to limit power into an extension of their power. First, they dissolved the NPA's investigative arm, the Scorpions, because by Kweda Mantashe's own admission, it had successfully targeted ANC leaders. Next, the ANC fired Vusi Pikoli, the man who had originally charged Zuma and refused to withdraw the charges as head of the NPA. Then the ANC put enough pressure on the NPA's acting head for him to drop the charges against Zuma. The coup de grace was the appointment of Menzi Simelane as head of the NPA. This is a man who openly denigrates the constitutional principle of prosecutorial independence. With Simelane in charge, Zuma and the Jacobins can sleep at night knowing that the NPA is in safe hands. The subverting of the NPA's independence gives us an idea of what the Jacobins will do to attain and retain power, but it doesn't end there. The judiciary, the last line of defense for the separation of powers, is periodically threatened if it doesn't toe the line. The conclusion is inescapable. The Jacobins are abusing the institution of the criminal justice system to protect their political allies, purge their opponents, entrench their power, and enrich themselves.
You're listening to an excerpt from a speech delivered by Democratic Alliance Helen Zille at the F.W. de Klerk Foundation celebration of the 20-year anniversary of de Klerk's speech in Parliament on February 2nd, 1990. It's read by our associate producer, Tiger Bresler. And again, this is Raising Sand Radio at Stanford University's KZSU FM 90.1. We are airing a series of extracts from various perspectives and leaders, and taking stock of how far South Africa has come and how far it still has to go to realize the hopes and dreams expressed for the nation at that time. Helen Zille goes on to suggest that the current ANC leaders are taking control of the levers of communications. Let's hear what she has to say.
The Constitution sees the SABC as a public broadcaster, but the ANC believes it should be the party's broadcaster. The new broadcasting bill, if passed, will give the Minister of Communication, who happens to be one of the Jacobins, excessive power to interfere in the SABC. The rest of the media remains independent, but by no means secure. The ANC Polokwane resolution to make the press accountable to Parliament in the form of a media tribunal may not have materialized, but other threats lurk in the form of recent enactment and proposed legislation. The amendment to the Film and Publication Act allows for pre-publication censorship of certain publications. The Protection of Information Bill, which has been withdrawn for now, criminalizes the publication of sensitive information if it is deemed to threaten the national interest. Meanwhile, amendments to the National Key Points Act would, if passed, impose a media blackout on the coverage of strikes, protests, demonstrations, industrial accidents, and criminal attacks. These pieces of legislation taken together give the ANC government as much power to exert control over the print and broadcasting media as the apartheid government had. The 17th Constitutional Amendment Bill, gazetted last year, is designed to strip away the power of municipalities with its federal principles rooted in our constitution. If the bill were to be passed in its current form, it would reduce municipalities to little more than agents of national government, regardless of the party in charge and its electoral mandate. The ANC periodic's threat to scrap or reduce the number of provinces would, if carried out, amount to the same thing at provincial level. But any rational observer of our politics knows that it is not provincial and local autonomy that hampers service delivery. So it is the ANC policy of deploying cadres, often without the requisite skill, to all centres of power, itself an unconstitutional practice. This is why the only provincial and local administrations at work are not run by the ANC. In the DA, we reject cadre deployment. We appoint the right people in the right places. The result over time is better service delivery and more opportunities for citizens. What is really realized or analyzed is the study of the tragic phenomenon known as the failed state, is that its root cause is cadre deployment. Cadre deployment is a lever of power abuse. It is used by the ruling clique of the ruling party to place its political allies in all positions of power and influence, inside and outside the state. The purpose is to entrench the inner circle's power and promote its enrichment. The inevitable trajectory is this: centralization of power, cadre deployment, cronyism, corruption, and the criminal state. This involves the destruction of the Constitution. It means the death of the economy. As capital and skills flee for safer environment, it means increased poverty and unemployment and all the associated evils. It also destroys the capacity of the state to deliver services. But when the people rise in revolt, the ruling clique use the institution of state designed to protect the people against the people. The police, the army, and the so-called Independent Electoral Commission become institutions that protect the ruling elite. All these developments point to one thing: our covenant, so cherished by President F.W. de Klerk and Mandela, and every genuine patriot, is in danger. The counter-revolution has begun. And ironically, while people like Malema rail against the counter-revolutionaries, they do not understand that they are the real counter-revolutionaries. They are undermining the constitution that we are protecting. Malema and his cohorts want to take us back to a time when the party, not the constitution, reigned supreme. They want one set of laws for the power and another for everybody else. Some people say our top priority is to protect the Constitution. They say it should be service delivery. Now, I know that you cannot live in a Constitution or eat a Constitution, but unless we protect our Constitution, we will enter the cycle that leads to a failed state in which fewer and fewer can improve the quality of their lives. Unless we protect the Constitution, there will not be a service delivery. It is the Constitution that obliges the state to realize progressively socio-economic rights like housing, education, health care, food, water, and security. The Constitution doesn't just limit power abuse. It places an obligation on the party in power to deliver to the poor. If the ANC is capable of removing impediments to its power, it is quite capable of ignoring its constitutional duty to the most marginalized South Africans.
That was an excerpt from a speech delivered by Democratic Alliance leader Helen Zille at the de Klerk Foundation's celebration of the 20-year anniversary of de Klerk's speech in 1990, when Mandela was unconditionally released along with other political prisoners and political parties. Meanwhile, President Jacob Zuma has apologized to the nation for his sexual adventures again, but critics have questioned his sincerity and asked whether he is fit to lead the country. This from the local Sunday Times. In a week of drama, Zuma issued two contrasting statements about revelations that he had fathered his 20th child, this one with Sonono Khoza and the daughter of soccer don Ivan Khoza. In the first statement, Zuma was defiant, saying his personal affairs were private. In the second, he acknowledged the groundswell of revulsion against his behavior. This is the third major scandal to beset Zuma. First was the trial that led to the imprisonment of his financial advisor, fraudster Shabir Sheikh. The second was the trial in which he was acquitted of rape, but admitting to having unprotected sex with a comrade's daughter who was HIV positive. Zuma said he deeply regretted the pain he had caused his family, the ANC, and the South Africans. Quote, "I also acknowledge and understand the reaction of many South Africans," unquote. But he had taken responsibility for the child, and he was committed to the importance of the family as an institution and to the values of personal responsibility, respect, and dignity. He added, "I recognize the responsibility of leaders to uphold and promote these values at all times." Nevertheless, a key member of the Tripartite Alliance reportedly said this week, "I want to find a huge rock to crawl under." This is the sentiment expressed by people who were ardent Zuma defenders at his corruption and rape trials. After he was acquitted of rape, Zuma apologized to the nation for the public messages he had put out about HIV prevention. Quote, "We went to the wall for Zuma," a source close to the president said. "He had a sense of entitlement with women, and it sends out completely the wrong message about HIV." The article goes on that critics slam Zuma and Zulu traditionalists warned him not to use polygamy to justify straying beyond the bedrooms of his three wives and his fiancé. Commentator Rhoda Kadili said, "Everyone she spoke to was enraged. There is a difference between polygamy and screwing around," she said. Zuma went to ground last week, taking a two-day break from his hectic schedule, and reportedly retreated to his forest town, Johannesburg home, where the children he fathered with Mozambican air hostess Kate Zuma, who committed suicide several years ago, live. It also emerged recently that in the run-up to his election as ANC president, Zuma came clean on his sexual escapades with his party colleagues and vowed not to embarrass the party further. President Zuma will make a State of the Nation address this week, and we'll keep abreast of what unfolds 20 years after the remarkable unconditional release of Nelson Mandela and the beginning of what was expected to be a democratic nation after apartheid. I'm going to try and bring more views from the current politics of South Africa in the next couple of weeks. We're certainly at a crossroads in this country. Again, this is Susan Gallimore, host of the weekly hour-long Raising Sand radio, airing on Stanford University's KZSU. And that's our show for this week. As usual, all views and opinions are those of the host and guests, and not KZSU or Stanford University. Tune in again next week to listen live on Pacific Times, California time, 2 to 3 at Stanford University's KZSU FM 90.1. You can go to our website, raisingsandradio.org, to listen to our internet streaming show, or you can simply download any of our shows at your convenience at their website, raisingsandradio.org. You can email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org to comment on our shows or suggest topics for future shows. We'll go out with the music of expatriates, the late Kapi Moto and George Peary.
nashangasana nashangasana makosa umenikosea nashangasana 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 kwa makosa umenikosea kipenzi changu mama nashinda kya kufanya leo watu wata wa makosa naka lakini kwangu misi wane makosa watu wote wamekosa naka mama watoto weko nalia nyumbani mama yuko wapi lakini mimi nashinda kujibu Kipenzi changu mama sijui nini tafanya leo machozi imeja machoni lakini roho yangu mie nauma kwa wiki nifanye nini mama hadhara mbaya waza nyuma uchungu mateso watoto wamebaki peke hata roho uzazi hakuna Nashangasana, 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 kama kosa umenikosea. Nashangasana, 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 kama kosa umenikosea. Kipenzi changu mama sijui nini tafanya leo lakini napata haja mbele ya watu mama kwa makosa umenikosea umenipatiza haya mama waza kweli nyuma watoto rudia kweli tuchunge watoto bado kukomea mama sijui nini takupa Nashangasana 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 Kwa makosa umenikosea Nashangasana